The book of Daniel, as you know, we've been looking, covers this span of 70, 80 years in the history of Israel, and it covers a span of time when they're, you know, started at the beginning of a captivity and they start coming out of that captivity. And early on, a couple of questions that aren't specifically asked in questions, but I think are the implied questions that the text is answering, has to do with God himself. I mean, is God really a sovereign God? Is the God of Israel just like all the other gods? At this time period, every country had its announced god, or gods most likely. And when they had great victories, it was because of their gods. And when they were defeated, their gods just weren't as strong as the other gods. When Israel is defeated, surely that becomes the question. Maybe not so much a question in Israel, but a question in the world. A question to the nations that are reigning over Israel at this time, Babylon and the other countries that would come. And part of Daniel is about answering that question. No, it's saying, even though Israel is no longer a sovereign country, their God is the sovereign God. And so, King Nebuchadnezzar may be the Gentile king who is reigning over Israel, but Yahweh is the sovereign God who reigns over Nebuchadnezzar. The other question that would be asked in this time period is, what is the destiny of Israel? And not given in a short view of, well, this you're going to be in captivity 70 years, but a much longer span of a history of Israel becomes the answer through a variety of dreams and visions, some by like Nebuchadnezzar, and some by Daniel. Daniel interpreting the dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, and angels coming and interpreting the dreams of Daniel. And they all give an outline of history, a kind of a near history for the most part. This is what will happen in the next 300 or 400 years. There will be Babylon, and after Babylon will come Media Persia, and after Media Persia will come Greece, and after Greece will come Rome. And while those countries may have not been known at that time and not necessarily been given by name, there were certain indicators that surely allows us to look back in history and say, oh, that's clearly them. And even to the point of saying there will be, in the Media Persian, there will be after the first king, there will be another king and another king and another king, and given exactly how many kings until this great king of Greece that will sweep across, which surely was Alexander the Great. Well, these are all given in sometimes in a very panoramic view of history, but embedded within several of these is something that is beyond, something that's greater than this near history, and it's a very distant history. As we start seeing a reference to a little big horn and a little this and that, and these inferences of the end time and an antichrist. Well, as Daniel progresses in his age and moves on and comes to that point of recognizing that the 70 years of captivity is upon him, and he prays for forgiveness for the nation and witnesses some of the people returning to Jerusalem, then the question kind of revisits itself about the destiny of Israel, because it's, you know, here they're returning. So what does that hold for Israel? And again, a vision comes to Daniel, and it's laid out in this panoramic view of what's ahead, and it moves through the kings. And as we saw and ended last week with not only the kings of Media Persia that will come, and then the kings of Greece, and how that will be divided up into four kingdoms after Alexander's death. But one will arise and become a great tormentor of Israel. And Antiochus Epiphanes was indeed that. He was also very much a type of the Antichrist. And in the last part of chapter 11, it switches from talking about Antiochus Epiphanes to talking about the Antichrist. The shift is subtle. It's not announced like this is the Antichrist. And if you look with me in chapter 11 and verse 36, there's not these clear indicators that we're changing topics. But there are some subtle indicators. It begins, it says, then the king. And we ask the question, what king? For the one previously referred to that we understand to be Antiochus Epiphanes was never referred to as the king. As a matter of fact, when we go back and look in all of chapter 11 for the king, there's never a reference to the king. There's references to the king of the south and the king of the north, but not simply this king, the king. And so there seems to be a shift here. Also, where Antiochus Epiphanes, as it was describing it in the previous verses, seemed to come to the end of his course, this one seems to be renewing this and describing afresh of one starting his course. Also, we see that things that are said here parallel other things that are in Daniel and other verses about the Antichrist. And this would lead us to believe this is definitely a shift. And we've moved from that near history where Antiochus Epiphanes in 150, 160 years before Christ just was a terror to Israel and had a desecration, of the temple where he the abominations and the things that he did and attempting to stop a worship. And this person had this significant impact, negative, horrible impact on Israel, which led to the Maccabean revolt and where Israel came out from under that, and then Rome comes into power. But that's not the end. And this passage moves more looking at what happens at the very end. You know, the whole aspect of eschatology, it's not like evangelicals are, there is a united theology. Generally, evangelical is defined as a belief in the gospel and a belief in at least a Bible that has great authority, if not and inspired, if not not necessarily inerrant anymore within evangelical circles. But clearly, evangelical embraces two things: that there is direct, real, reliable revelation from God, and that the gospel of Jesus Christ. He died and he was resurrected. There are a lot of general things held within evangelical circles based upon those two things. You're going to have very common views of God and common views of salvation. But one of the things that has the greatest differences, the greatest discrepancy, would be in the area of eschatology, things yet to come. And historically, there's been three positions, and they all have to do with defining the millennium. And the millennium as such, for that definition, comes from Revelation 20, where it speaks of 1,000 years. And there have been three positions that have been held, three views, and they are what could be, and it's all related to that term millennium. So it's all millennium, post-millennium, and premillennium. And it's all related to that term millennium and the return of Christ. What is the relationship of the return of Christ to the millennium? So if you're an evangelical, then you would believe that Jesus Christ is going to return. So there's not a debate in that group. Is Christ going to return? It's just, what is his return? How does his return relate to the term millennium? And so if you're in a group called all millennial, the all negates the millennium. There is no earthly millennium in relationship to Christ's return. So there is no millennium. There is no earthly reign of Christ in relationship to his return. He returns and the end of the ages began. Then there's a term post-millennial. So post meaning that Christ returns at the end of the millennium. Well, obvious within that then, it's almost obvious. I don't know if it had to be obvious. But the 1,000 years is symbolic of a long period, not a literal 1,000 years. So there's not a literal reign of Christ on earth. Christ is not set up on a throne on earth. But Christ has a millennial kingdom that's real over a long period of time. It is a spiritual kingdom, not an earthly kingdom in which he reigns. So with postmillennialism, in a very general sense, the world becomes Christianized. The world gets better and better. People become Christians. The numbers of Christians grow to such a point that the spiritual kingdom has overtaken the earth and Christ returns at that point. And then there's premillennialism, meaning Christ returns prior to the millennium. And that view is that the millennium is a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. Now, the postmillennialism is an intriguing one because it comes and goes off the scenes in the last 100 years or so. The last 150 years, it's been prominent. It's totally off the scene. It comes back to prominence. When I first became a Christian, I was attending a church in Amarillo, and there was a Christmas Bible conference, and the guest speaker was speaking on something related to eschatology, at least part of it, because he was explaining the different views. And I so clearly remember as he was going through explaining, he said, yeah, postmillennialism, just think of that as a fence post. It's dead. Nobody believes that. And that was in the early 70s. Well, it's very prominent theology today. Postmillennialism had one of its greatest days at the turn of the 18th to the 19th century. You know, as if you recall what was going on at the very end of the 1800s in the field of science, was Darwin had beat others to the press to announce evolution. And in a oversimplistic view, evolution says things are getting better and better and better. Postmillennialism says things are going to get better and better and better. And there was a clear, you know, correlation as people were buying into theologies. And it's interesting how you do that. And so you come along to the First World War, and that was very devastating. How do you explain a war that includes the whole world if the world is supposed to be getting better? And then when the Second World War came, or the First World War became known as the war to end all wars, that's how you explain it. Is this is the final war of all these kind of wars. But then when you have the Second World War, that put a real dagger in postmillennialism. But it has resurfaced, and it's resurfaced in a couple of different ways. And one is under something that's called dominion theology, which is a Christianization of the United States. It looks at the United States in terms of saying it is equivalent to Israel. All the promises, all the way God reacted to Israel, that's how he reacts to a Christian view of the United States. And so as Christians, we should be about making this a Christian nation. And so through legal means, through everything, you impose Christianity upon a culture. Not necessarily convert a culture. I'm not talking about speaking the gospel and converting people. It's through policies and living, and maybe all the Christians move together in an area, and it becomes that way of changing, and through laws and making this that Christian nation, so that you could allow Christ to return. Well, you know, you have these basic views, and then thrown in here, not as a millennial view, but a term that's around a lot today, is called preterist. And that has to do, it's primarily today, people that are in post-millennial views, but it can be all males that hold this view too. But it's basically saying all the revelation about end times, the stuff from Matthew 24, most of Revelation, all of those things occurred before 70 AD. So almost all revelation of things to come, from our perspective, have already taken place, and they took place before 70 AD. But you still have these three major views. It's either all, post, or pre. When I was in seminary, I came to the realization that, a couple of things. One, that I was at a seminary that was premillennial. That wasn't real hard to come to that realization. But the other one was, I was premillennialist. I was a premillennialist for one reason, or maybe two reasons. They're connected. It's that when I became a Christian, I started listening to a certain Bible teacher, and through connections with that, started going to a Bible church. And because of the connection to that Bible church, went to Dallas Seminary. And so in one sense, I'm thinking, I never made a decision to be a premillennialist. It was just a part of the groups I was around. So I started reading about it. And one of the things that I came across was in more than one, in several books by all millennialists, as they described the different views and the systems, they said that if you interpret Scripture literally, you would be premillennial. And if you interpret, and this is talking about prophecies, if you interpret prophecies figuratively, then you're all millennialist. And indeed, that's the major distinction. If you look at Old Testament prophecies and you interpret them literally, then it leads one to be a premillennialist. If you interpret Old Testament prophecies symbolically, figuratively, then you'll be post-mill or all-mill. Then there's a group within premillennialists that come along and they look at Revelation 20 that talks about 1,000 years. And they say, because of that 1,000 years, because it says clearly 1,000 years, we believe there will be a literal earthly millennial kingdom. And so they're premillennials. But they look at the Old Testament and they say, we're not sure what to do with Old Testament prophecies. And so, thus within premillennialists, there are two groups. There's those that look at the Old Testament and say, you look at Old Testament prophecies and interpret them literally, and those are called dispensationalists. And then there is another group that says, we don't know what to do with the Old Testament, but when we look at the New Testament, we clearly see it's premillennial. And they're what are called historical premillennialists. You can be sure of which one came along later, because they're the one that has the better name, the historic premillennialist. If you get to choose your name, you often win by default, by the names you choose. There's nothing truly to show that that's the historic position. But those are our views. I say all of that to say that when I look at this passage and we talk about it being the Antichrist and we talk about the tribulation, it's clearly putting together passages throughout the Bible to bring about that theology. We're not going to find a passage in the Bible that says, okay, here's this outline, and it lays it out for us as we might see on an eschatological chart. We don't have that scripturally. But these views come, and there is a consistency that if you look at the Old Testament and you say, if I interpret these passages literally, I mean, it's a figure of speech, but you take figure of speeches literally, you recognize it's a figure of speech, but you're not just looking at, because it's prophecy, I'm going to say it's symbolic. You interpret it normatively. That even those that don't agree would say, yeah, that's what the position will be. And my question to myself, or answer myself in seminary, and it still continues today, is, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I interpret it normatively? And so when we come to a passage like this, and we talk about the Antichrist and talking about the tribulation, the reason that I would go there, as opposed to maybe some other, if you have notes in a Bible or a commentary that might say, start talking about it as being some other time period or something else, because it's they hold a different millennial view, is because of that position of saying, okay, I'm going to take Old Testament prophecies and interpret them normatively. And it leads to that position. And so what we see in the tribulation then is the tribulation, as we saw in Daniel 9, becomes that 70th week of Daniel. That Daniel was talking about 70 weeks, and 69 weeks took us up to the triumphal entry of Christ. And then following the triumphal entry of Christ, in between that 69th and 70th week, the Messiah was cut off. That is, he was crucified. And then what we've seen is a large gap of time has taken place. But that 70th week will still yet come. And in that, there will one that will come on the scene that will set himself up to be basically the Messiah. God in flesh, God on earth, God himself, not the Son of God, because he wouldn't even share, not that that's an appropriate Trinitarian view, but not even an idea that he would share that he's God's Son, that is delegated. No, he is God himself. And that's what we see in this passage. The Antichrist exalts himself. In chapter 11 of Daniel, in verse 36, that it says, then the king will do as he pleases. The king will do as he pleases. And he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. This word indignation in the middle of verse 36 is a word in describing intense hatred, and it's everything would point to it being a word that would parallel the tribulation, would be a word during that tribulation period. He exalts himself. He does as he pleases. He magnifies himself above every god. He speaks out against all of the God of God, so that's Yahweh, and he overrides all the gods. He has no regard for any traditions, the God of the fathers, where it says for the desire of women. Doesn't seem to fit the context at all, but by the very wording, it could be in the sense of there's no romantic interest in women, but that doesn't seem to fit the context at all. It doesn't fit the references where Antiochus Epiphanes was a type of the Antichrist. It possibly is in the sense of that he doesn't possess those characteristics that would be associated with women in a general sense of being gracious and compassionate. But more likely what it refers to here is that the desire of women, was in that Jewish sense of there is a Messiah coming and being the mother of that Messiah. That there's no regard for a Messiah. There's no regard for anything because that's who he is, essence. Not the Messiah of the Old Testament, but the essence of he is God. He replaces everything. And so here we are in this world now that we more and more about tolerance. You know, you got to tolerate all religions. Here comes one upon the scene that says, hey, let's get rid of all religions. And you can almost see how that would even happen. Saying, you know, religions are the cause of all this. Get rid of them all. And he exalts himself as the main object of worship. Daniel 7:25, and this is speaking of the Antichrist in a different passage. He will speak out against the Most High, that is against God, Yahweh, and wear down the saints, the highest one, that is Israel, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law. See, he will speak out. In Daniel 8:25, another passage about the Antichrist, and through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence, and he will magnify himself in his heart. 2 Thessalonians 2:3-4. Let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first. And the man of lawlessness, and that's another reference to the Antichrist, is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. He magnifies himself. You know, our world, our society, the Western society, not necessarily the world, but at this point, but Western society, it almost lives to empower people to magnify themselves. Now, once they do that, they may be greatly criticized, but everything going up to it, they're in favor of. LeBron James, in basketball terminology, was a free agent, so he could sign with any team that he wanted to, that wanted him. And so he came up with a shopping list, and he met with 4 or 6 teams. And then, in the course of this, and it was going to be over these few days, had said, okay, then he would have an announcement, prime time, like 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. And it wouldn't just be, you know, him coming to a microphone and announcing it, but it's going to be a 30-minute program. And as I understand, it's 20 minutes into the program before the question is ever asked to him. Now, what was most intriguing about this is all the criticism after the fact. And ESPN sportscasters that are very critical of it, even though they're always acknowledging it's ESPN that has played right along with this and carried this, and it was their own program that arranged for it not to be announced until 20, or the question to even be asked until 20 minutes in it. So here you have even one organization that allows, you know, does everything they can to create somebody just to magnify themselves and then turn around and be critical of them for doing it. See, our society really is that way. It's like, oh, yeah, go for it. Have an announcement. You know, magnify yourself. And then afterwards, say, what? You know, that's really, you know, kind of a self-acclaimed king. I don't know about that. And so the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers that desperately wanted King James to come back to his team after he announces he's going to Miami, says this self-proclaimed king and begins to tear him down. See, everybody wants that. They like that when they can market it, but then they can be against it. Well, if that can happen in sports, if that can happen in different areas, what is it like when one that comes with the power of Satan comes on the scene? It is not hard to imagine that people will be right there and saying, yeah, get rid of all their religions. Yes, you set yourself up. Yes, we will honor you. It may not be so much of them recognizing that they are saying, oh, you're God, as much as it is that they start to function that way while he claims himself to be God. Well, the Antichrist also exalts his power in verses 38 to 39. But instead, he will honor a god of fortress. So, as opposed to the traditional religions, it becomes a god of power. A god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. And will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. And he will give great honor to those who acknowledge him and will cause them to rule over the many and parcel out the land for a price. So he comes into great power. And then he's in battle. Others come against him in battle, and he finds himself in Israel and being attacked from various sides. And 40 through 44, really, or 45 speak of this. At the end of the time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through. He will also enter the beautiful land, that is Israel, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt. And then in verse 44, but rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his tents, the tents of his royal pavilion, between the sea and the beautiful holy mountain. But notice, he's defeated. He is defeated. Yet, he will come to his end, and no one will help him. It's just so sudden. I mean, he is the one, the self-exalted king, the God of the world, the God of the universe. He's announced himself. He has so powerfully taken on everyone, but something shifts, and this war comes about. And then it says he's defeated. Daniel 8:25, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. He will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, that is the Messiah, but he will be broken without human agency. In 2 Thessalonians, then that lawlessness one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming. It's very interesting in 2 Thessalonians as Paul is explaining that they are not in the time of the day of the Lord because the Antichrist has not come yet. And then he's going to lay out this course, this path that the Antichrist will walk. And Paul says, at the very beginning, before he lays out the path, he says, he gives this part, but the Lord will slay him with the breath of his mouth. And when the Lord comes, when the Lord appears, that will be his defeat. And then he says, now let me tell you what he's going to do. And he describes all the destruction. But it's all almost as Paul is saying, okay, I'm going to tell you the end first so you won't get too upset about this. See, that's one of the things we need to know. And if you're asking the question, what is the destiny of Israel? You need to understand, yeah, there's going to be some tough times and it's devastating. And there's this period of tribulation and all this goes on. But the Antichrist is defeated. He's defeated without human agencies. It's not as though there's this great war that humans devise and unseat him. No, it's God that does it. Well, then as we move into the first three verses of chapter 12, there are two promises that give hope. Two promises that give hope. The first is that Israel will be delivered. Israel will be delivered. Now, at that time, at what time? Well, I would think it's at that time when it goes back to verse 14. It says, at the end time. We're talking about during this tribulational period, at this end time, this climactic time. Now, at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, that is Israel, will arise. And there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, again, Israel, this emphasis, your people, everyone who is found in the book of life will be rescued. You know, there is deliverance. But not only that, there's a resurrection. Many of those who sleep, being a nice way of saying those who are dead, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake. These to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven. And those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And so Daniel, in this passage, it speaks of a resurrection to life, a resurrection to judgment and death. In Revelation 20, it speaks of two resurrections. A resurrection of life to those that prior to after the tribulation and right before the millennial kingdom, that there's a resurrection. And then at the end of that millennial kingdom, that there's a resurrection for judgment. That this passage in Daniel about the resurrection becomes a primary passage in the New Testament, the Gospel, of this concept of resurrection. There is a resurrection, but there's two. And that's important in this promise, that those that walk with Yahweh, those that are in this covenant relationship with Yahweh, there's a resurrection to life. But God does also judge. And so here is Israel, or here's Daniel at toward the end of his life, and he has been involved in either interpreting or being the instrument, the agent of a revelation, and has laid out the destiny of Israel, and that Yahweh is sovereign over Gentiles and Gentile rulers. But then when it comes specifically about Israel and it's the destiny of Israel, it comes down to, yeah, there are going to be a lot of tough times. And there's going to be this very intense period. And that we know from Daniel 9, that's the 70th week of Daniel, the tribulation period. And yet, at the end of it, there are three things that are certain. Antichrist is defeated. Israel is delivered. And there is a resurrection. And the reason that is so important is because Daniel is looking at his nation. And he's in his 80s. And he's looking at all of these wars. And you're saying, there's two things going on. One is you're saying, this kingdom is a long ways off. People are going to die before we get there. And then you're looking at wars and various things. People are going to die. And so very much along the line is in 1 Thessalonians when people are concerned, they're like, what? You know, I thought the Lord was going to come back and we were going to be taken up with the Lord. And, you know, but now people have been dying. What's going to happen? And Paul says, well, you have to understand when this rapture occurs, whether people are dead or alive, they're going to be taken up to the Lord. And so Daniel is being told, the Antichrist will be defeated, Israel will be delivered, and those that believe in Yahweh, those that are in that relationship with Yahweh, those that are righteous, they will be resurrected. You know, for us, even though we're not the nation Israel, and some of these prophecies and some of these things in a technical sense don't apply to us, because it's looking at Israel at that end time of the tribulation or the millennium, it all relates. Because it's the same question, while it may not be specifically, what about our nation Israel, it still is the question of what about Israel? In the sense that God has made a promise. What about God's promises? Are God's promises real, or do they just kind of fade away at some point? Did he just say, well, I don't know, this thing with Israel is not working out, so I'm going to do this with the church now? See, I come along and say, no, he made these promises. They're there. Now we say, okay, he's going to keep those promises. The Antichrist comes on the scene, but the Antichrist will not win. Israel will be delivered. God will fulfill that promise, and God will populate that kingdom with his people through the resurrection. Well, if he can do that resurrection that he talks about here, then when Paul talks about a rapture, that my understanding would occur prior to that, which is a type of resurrection, I see it fits in perfectly with God's plans. That the resurrection that Daniel talks about, the rapture that Paul talks about, which is a form of resurrection, they're all built upon the fact that Jesus Christ was resurrected. And so these passages give us great hope. A hope, a sense of certainty, or a way of re-acknowledging that indeed Yahweh is supreme. Yahweh is the God. And he has a plan, and he will execute his plan. The Antichrist will come. The Antichrist will, quote, have great success, but he will be defeated. He's not going to be defeated because people finally came to their senses. He will be defeated by God, not by the hands of people. Israel will be delivered, and there will be a resurrection to life. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank you for your provisions in our lives. We thank you for your word. We thank you for Scripture. And we acknowledge that we understand it imperfectly. And so we ask for your insight and your illumination. But Father, there are some things that are very clear in Scripture, that aren't debatable, that you have a plan and you're executing that plan, that there is a resurrection, and that Christ will return. And we do pray in his name. Amen.